Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue. Before you worry, and I think he told you all, he's scheduled to be off. He's at spring training, taking some much-deserved, relaxing few days off. So we will hold the show steady, hold the ship steady in his absence, and proceed through the days together. You can join the conversation by emailing us panel@wamc.org. I am in Studio A this morning with Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Bo Breslin. Good morning, Bo.
Good morning, Sarah. It's always a treat to have you host the show, so I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, don't count on it. This one just started. Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, Bob Brigham, is here. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Hey, Sarah. It's always good to be here.
And Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. Hello, Malia.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Let us hop right down to Cuba, where a lot of drama erupted yesterday. This from the AP. Cuba's government said late last night that the 10 passengers on a boat that opened fire on its border soldiers were armed Cubans who were living in the U.S., who were trying to infiltrate the island with terroristic intentions. Earlier, Cuba had said that soldiers killed 4 people and wounded 6 others aboard a Florida-registered speedboat that had entered Cuban waters and opened fire on the soldiers first, who were also on the water, injuring one Cuban officer, Cuba's government said that the majority of the 10 people on the boat have a known history of criminal and violent activity. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told reporters that he was made aware of the incident and that the U.S. is now gathering its own information to determine if the victims were American citizens or permanent residents. The Cuban government identified 2 of the boat passengers as Amahel Sanchez Gonzalez and Leorden Enrique Cruz Gomez, who are wanted by Cuban authorities for previous alleged terroristic activities. From Al Jazeera, this is another little bit more about the people on the boat that we learned about. Cuba's interior ministry identified one of the 4 deceased as Michael Ortega Casanova and also revealed the names of the 6 suspects arrested on the boat. Their mission, according to the interior ministry, was to carry out an infiltration for terrorist purposes on Cuban soil. It accused the 10 men of transporting guns, Molotov cocktails, bulletproof vests, and camouflage as part of their efforts. The 7th arrest, the ministry added, was made within Cuba itself. That person, identified as Dunil Hernandez Santos, was described as a citizen sent from the United States to facilitate the reception of the armed infiltration. He has also been referred to as the truck driver or the getaway guy. Very dramatic, involving, obviously, governments saying, giving their takes on it, et cetera. People were killed on the water and others arrested. A big story just 90 miles off the coast of Florida. Bob.
Well, this sounds a little to me like a private Bay of Pigs. the description of this vehicle, this boat as a speedboat, is where I'd like to start because according to the vehicle registration, it's a 1981 Proline, 24 feet. You're not going to outrun anybody in a 1981 24-foot Proline. You also shouldn't have 10 passengers on it. I don't know where
they're going. Are you a boat guy?
Yeah, I'm a boat guy.
Okay. Oh. He just showed us a tattoo of an anchor on his hand.
I don't know where you're going to put guns, ammunition, and anything else on this 24-foot Proline. It's a family fishing boat. It's not a speed boat. If the registration's correct. Now, they could have dummied that registration very easily. But it's consistent with the rest of the story that this is a group of folks that lived in Florida who were Cubans who, thought they were going to launch this private Bay of Pigs. Clearly within Cuban waters, clearly not well thought out, clearly probably not coordinated in any way with any other entity. It just is one of those things that probably the timing of this is going to be more significant than the actual event because of the stranglehold on Cuba right now with the embargo on the oil. I mean, this is not the headline we expect about Cuba. We expect that 95-year-old Raul Castro is going to pass away and there'll be a transition and the United States is going to force that transition through its embargoes and its other policies in the area. This is not helpful, actually, to all of to creating any kind of stability in U.S.-Cuban relations.
Malia?
Well, Bob's a boat guy. I didn't know that about the boat sank you. I'm coming at this from the perspective of someone with a background in intelligence. So I want to talk a little bit about what we know and what we don't know about this situation. So everything that's in the public record so far about what happened is from the Cuban government. And the Cuban government is not a reliable narrator. So their categorization of all the people who are on the boat as terrorists, that's coming from the perspective of an authoritarian regime that has restricted any kind of democratic expression. And so once we learn more about who these people were, we probably would not agree, or we probably will not agree with that characterization that the Cuban government made of those people. The Cuban government also said that they opened fire first, which I find extremely unlikely to be the case. A speedboat, or whether it was a speedboat or not, that's trying to infiltrate Cuban waters I think it's more likely that the Cuban border police, I think is the entity that came upon them, tried to stop them, and they were trying to defend themselves and outrun. Now, this is all speculation at this point, and I don't think we'll ever have access to information to. But I'm just saying this is a more plausible narrative of events than what we're hearing from the Cuban government. One of the things we don't know is whether this is in fact the only infiltration that has been attempted or taken place. So the fact that someone had already flown into Cuba to plan to meet them, how many other people have done that? We know that Southern Florida has a very large Cuban population. There have been a lot of people there for a long time trying to support movements toward democracy in Cuba. And so the fact that people are trying to infiltrate, people that the Cuban government calls terrorists are trying to infiltrate, that is not a surprise. I think probably other boatloads have gotten through and are over time. Now, the questions I have and what I hope we might learn about, maybe as the U.S. government looks into this a little bit more, we might learn more about what intelligence the U.S. government has, how much we know about how many Cubans have been trying to get into Cuba. This is a particularly vulnerable time for the Cuban government because of the effects of the oil blockade and other actions the Trump administration has taken, and also because their leader is really old and the economy of Cuba has been crumbling for a long time. So I think it's for people in the Cuban diaspora, this moment in times probably seems optimal for them to try to take action when the government is weak. And so these people in this boat got caught. I think they're probably not the only ones who are engaged in these kinds of actions.
Beau?
Yeah, let me just build off of what Malia and Bob said by offering a couple of different things. One is Malia's right when we think about those Cuban Americans. The Miami Herald data is pretty interesting. 66, this is the most recent data coming out of the Miami Herald, 66% of Cuban Americans oppose the normalization of relations with Cuba. That's 66%. 70% support keeping Cuba on the state-sponsored terrorism list. And but what I find most interesting is that 43% of Cuban Americans support those two things. Only 43% of those Cuban Americans who were born in the U.S. So it's a much higher percentage of those people who are immigrants from Cuba than the younger generation. And we're seeing that a lot in various other parts of the domestic agenda. I guess what I would suggest is, the other thing I would throw out before I throw questions to the three of you, the other thing I'd throw out is the significant shifting alignment to the Republican Party over the last generation from Cuban Americans, and in particular this last presidential election. To what extent, one question I'll throw out, to what extent does this help the Trump administration, the story? And, you know, Marco Rubio was tepid and surprisingly.
He was incredibly restrained.
He was incredibly restrained. And then the one question I'll throw out to those who really know more than I do, is the U.S. policy outdated, right? That is, It's basically 60 years old now. It's based on old Cold War interests. It has not produced regime change. Cuba, if anything, has moved closer to China and Russia in the last decade or two. Cuba is even less of a threat today than it was probably, Bob, tell me if I'm wrong, at any time in the last 60 years. So at some point, is our policy towards Cuba outdated? I think Obama and Biden tried to loosen things a little bit.
Yeah, Biden moved toward the normalization process, much like they did with Vietnam in the 1990s. There was a pathway, Cuba and the United States were negotiating terms of full normalization. It happened briefly, very, very briefly, in 2015, and then that shut down, and we're back into this cycle. I do think it's an interesting time in U.S.-Cuban relations for a variety of reasons, and one is that, you know, Rubio's in the neighborhood. He's St. Kitts right now, meeting with the other, his equivalents in the neighborhood. And he was incredibly restrained. But at the same time, on the same day, same exact day this happened, there was the beginning of lawsuits aiming to claim back territory lost after Batista fell in 1959. I mean, it just seems a little coincidental, this. In general, in international relations theory, I think that moving Cuba toward normalization was a good move. The United States placed Cuba on the Trading with the Enemy Act list of 1917, along with North Korea, Vietnam, and a few others. Those situations never really work out well. It costs a lot of money. They create a lot of psychological terror where there doesn't need to be. We punished Vietnam for 20 years, following the Vietnam War. There's a lot at stake, but there's also not that much at stake. That's the kind of key. You got to thread this. And the United States hasn't been very good diplomatically on Cuba.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Time also has this information, that the ministry identified one of the seven passengers we mentioned, Michel Ortega Casanova, who's one of the deceased. Ortega Casanova's brother, Misael, told the Associated Press that Michelle had lived for more than 20 years in the U.S. as an American citizen, worked as a truck driver, and is survived by his wife, mother, two sisters, and a pregnant daughter. The brother said that no one knew of his plans, but he had fallen into an obsessive and diabolical quest to free Cuba, and he hopes that his brother's death will justify that Cuba will someday be free, which, as we were saying about the all of the information coming from the Cuban government and them not being a reliable narrator, is the voice of the protests not represented in the coverage. Mm-hmm. The desire for a free Cuba just subsumed in the story of speedboats that maybe weren't speedy and gunshots on the water.
Right, and you know, Bob called this a private Bay of Pigs. Is it also a private Iran-Contra? That is to say, who's supporting these I think I heard on NPR these are small organizations in South Florida who are funding, you know, their own internal attempt to regime change. Are we eventually going to find out that there's a track from here to the White House in terms of support for these kind of small operations?
And until we have forensics on the actual what was on board, this cost $118 worth of gas. And, you know, if this was if somebody went out and bought a new regulator, you know, four or five, and these are well armed, but this is like you got your cousin's boat, you know, from 1981. You filled it with gas, with diesel, and you went. I mean, it's not.
I don't think so, Bo, to answer your question. I don't think we're going to find it because the Trump administration's interests and policies in the Western Hemisphere haven't been necessarily in support of democracy. They've been in support of stability. And the Cuba in its current state from a Trump administration perspective is stable, even though it's crumbling. And so I don't think they want to see some sudden regime change, even if it's going in the direction of democracy, because it could create some wave of migrants and in a humanitarian emergency just 90 miles off the coast of Florida. So I think that helps explain why Rubio is so restrained about this. And basically, I think he even said, we're taking the Cuban government's word for it, right. Something along those lines. Yeah. So I think they'll pay plenty of lip service to freedom fighters, but I don't think there's any real support there.
And I'm sort of asking that question tongue in cheek because, of course, you know, we went in and took out Maduro in front of the entire world. So, I mean, technically, Trump could go in and try some stuff for regime change. He doesn't have to do it subtly by paying these, you know, these rinky-dink operations that 118 bucks later.
And if he thought Castro was, like, an actual danger to the United States right now, I'm not sure he would be restrained from doing that. But I think, like, what is the danger of Cuba to the United States right now? Like, you asked about, like, the past 60 years, it's certainly changed. It used to be a potential outpost for Soviet activity, right? Like a land-based aircraft carrier of a sort. Now, the danger, I think, again, from an administration perspective, is being overwhelmed by migrants. There aren't terrorist activities emanating out of Cuba against the United States, for example. So I think the administration is kind of content to let it lie.
Well, you also mentioned, Bo, that Cuba's moving closer to being aligned with Russia and China. Yeah. And I offer who amongst us, right? Like what other countries are trending that way of late?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that I'm driving down here, and maybe you guys heard, but I'm driving down here, and I always listen to Morning Edition when I'm driving down. And
thank you for
listening. No worries. got to keep the listeners up. I heard somebody say, I think it was Marketplace, say that the State Department is loosening the oil exports from Venezuela to Cuba, and I couldn't rewind it to hear that. Is that possible that just in the last day or so that the State Department has decided to sort of let Venezuelan oil get into Cuba a little bit more?
I think that's totally possible.
I think stringing things along. So they've by having this oil embargo, they've put a lot of pressure on the regime, but I don't think they want some sudden collapse. They're trying to make it harder for the regime to endure long, but without creating some kind of like huge upheaval suddenly. So that wouldn't surprise me. I didn't hear that particular thing, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We will return with Bo Breslin, Robert Brigham, and Malia Dumont after this news update from the BBC. Again, the email address, panel@WAMC.org, if you would like to pose a question or offer a comment. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc. We have a few emails from listeners on the Cuban topic, and we will read those and then move on to another topic. Pamela wrote in and said, okay, I'm old enough to remember the Cuban Missile Crisis from a grade school perspective. For decades, Cuba has been under embargo. There are many countries in the world which are worse actors on the world stage than Cuba. And in all those cases, sanctions are imposed and the rest of the world goes on about its business. What the heck is it about Cuba that has the U.S. hell-bent on wiping it out? And we talked to that a bit before the break, but let's go ahead, Bob.
I think a lot of this does date back to the missile crisis. And what we have to remember about the missile crisis is it did not change the balance of terror one bit. Mm. Right? That Kennedy, McNamara, and Bundy realized the psychological impact of the missile crisis, but the placement of the missiles was not going to change strategic balance. It was not going to change the balance of terror. It just felt more dangerous. And I think that's it. It's the proximity. And Cuba has been the victim of that proximity, but it also has been the beneficiary of that proximity. I think going back to what Malia was saying earlier, this is a slow pull because of the proximity. If it wasn't 90 miles off the coast of Florida, this issue would probably be over. because it wouldn't be in our consciousness the way it has been since April of 1961 when we launched the Bay of Pigs. And I should say the Bay of Pigs invasion was haphazard. Too. I mean, there was no air cover. The CIA had overestimated everything. Kennedy no longer trusted the CIA estimates after that. So it's always been that kind of psychological issue, and I think it'll remain so until relations are normalized.
Well, and let me follow up with another question to the group of you, and that is, I get this is, you know, sort of, I'm not eager to connect this up to the White House. Remember, it's Cuban folks from Florida and the Cuban Border Patrol who fired shots. That said, what role does the State Department Donroe Doctrine type stuff play in this particular exchange? Is this story just going to go away, or is it the Donroe Doctrine, Western Hemisphere, we need to command the area in a way that we haven't in a long time, is that going to give it legs?
I think if we discover that any of the people on the boat were actually American citizens, because I don't think we know that
they
yet.
We don't know yet if they were citizens or residents.
Yeah, then the State Department will have something to say about it. But I think the Donroe Doctrine is about stability in the Western Hemisphere. And it's not necessarily a pro-democracy strategy. And so I think they're going to try to, they being the administration, go past this story. And they had to say something because it sort of popped up on the news. It's a sensational headline. But I don't think they want this to be a continuing story.
Well, and so far only Rubio in the administration has said anything, right? We haven't heard from the president about it.
No.
As far as I've seen.
No.
Yeah, and this administration also isn't high on consistency necessarily. But if you think about Cuban Border Patrol, their approach to this incident, and you compare it to U.S. Border Patrol, I'm not sure the administration wants to criticize the approach that the Cuban Border Patrol took in this instance.
Sure. Yeah, if the stories are true, a mile off your coast is in your territorial waters. And if the stories are true that they had weapons, there's a narrative there that the Trump administration would not want to disrupt because it's a little too close to home.
Jose writes in and says, I'd like nothing more than to see the imprisoned dissidents in Cuba be released and for the island to be free of the oppression. But the Cuban Americans who took action on their own are no different than the January 6th mob that overran the Capitol. And I think that's an interesting point offered, but that is...
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand it. Could you say that again?
That they want, this writer, Jose, would like Cuba to be free.
Yeah.
But that this action, if true, and again, we only have the information from Cuba's government, but if true, then they were a mob. That was a mob action, a terrorist action. I guess they're not a mob. It's probably not enough. Does 10 people count as a mob? But I take the point, but I don't know.
I'm not sure the January 6th folks want America to be quote unquote free in the same way that the letter writer is suggesting is happening.
But do they think that they did? They think
oh,
that
yeah,
they did.
Yeah. Well, you can tell yourself anything. You can tell yourself any story.
Or not about this one.
And we're all laughing because we're worried about the world. That is. The stress release laughter of the on-air intelligentsia.
Sure.
Okay. A news story. Yesterday, a federal judge in Boston ruled that the Trump administration's policy of deporting undocumented immigrants to countries where they are not citizens is unconstitutional, saying the government must provide more time for people to legally challenge their removals over concerns that they could face imminent danger. U.S. District Judge Brian E. Murphy's final decision invalidates a policy memo last spring from the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement that allows enforcement officers to deport migrants to countries that are not their own with as little as 6 hours' notice. The ruling will make it more difficult for the administration, which immigration experts said have sent thousands of migrants to so-called third countries, to continue to use the practice as widely as authorities seek to speed up President Trump's mass deportation program.
Oh.
Yeah, so so what was it? Yogi Berra said deja vu all over again. It is deja vu all over again. And the reason it is because we're back at the district court level arguing the same thing in the same courts. And just as a reminder for the listeners, on June 23rd, 2025, the court's emergency docket receives an appeal, decided an appeal from the Department of Homeland Security to stay an April injunction from the First District of Massachusetts, same one, that stopped the deportation of folks to third countries. That stay was granted over the vehement dissent. It was a 17-page dissent on the shadow docket. That's a huge dissent by the three liberal justices. So basically what happens in that situation is the case starts over again, and it goes back to it can go back to the district courts. Will the Supreme Court eventually take this case on the merits? I think the answer is yes. They're going to have to, because we're just going to end up in this sort of cycle again. The issues are still the same that this district court judge is dealing with, right? The UN Convention prohibits deportation of folks that could face torture. ICE has given, quote unquote, assurances that these countries, El Salvador, South Sudan, places like that, will not torture individuals. The Trump administration is paying these countries to take these undocumented folks off of our hands. The loss of due process is one of the things that this court, this district court judge was particularly concerned about. So all this is sort of, you know, lather, rinse, repeat. And it's very important, obviously, for the folks who are involved in this and the litigants that are involved in this. But it's deja vu all over again. I will say one thing, though, that and Sarah was generous enough to let me riff off the. I do think the tariff decision of last week is an interesting, I don't know, backdrop to this particular case. Because as the press has done a very good job, and I'll say a couple things about this, the press has done a very good job of suggesting or reminding folks that this was the tariff case is the first case where the court hears on the merits the broad scope of Trump's attempts to, you know, expand executive power. All the other ones are shadow docket or emergency docket. This is the first one on the merits, and he lost, right? So 6-3, he gets Robert he loses Roberts, Gorsuch, and Amy Coney Barrett. What's interesting about that is I'm fairly sure that this case, even though the Trump administration won on the emergency docket back in June, this case might go the same way because there are some real problems with the Department of Homeland Security's and ICE's position on this. The last thing I'll say, which is super interesting, and the press hasn't done a good enough job of this, back to the tariff case, there is something that has largely slipped through the press's attention, and that is Chief Justice Roberts assigning the opinion to himself. So for the listeners who understand this stuff, The way it works at the Supreme Court is that if the Chief Justice is in the majority, the Chief Justice gets to assign the opinion to anybody else in the majority, including himself. If he's not in the majority, the most senior justice gets to assign the opinion. The fact that Roberts assigned the opinion to himself suggests to me that he's trying to take control of, as best he can, of the Trump administration's expansion of unitary executive. Now, I'm not a big Roberts fan, but he did not assign this. He's certainly not going to assign it to any of the three liberals, the tariff case. And he didn't assign it to Barrett and Gorsuch because he wants to control the narrative as best he can in a Supreme Court that he's sort of lost control of. So I'm hopeful that as more merit-based cases come before the Supreme Court, including this one that the Massachusetts District Court judge did, or Judge Boasberg doing the same thing, I'm hopeful that Roberts has regained some authority, because I think he's a more rational conservative voice on the court.
panel@wamc.org to join the conversation, and we will hear from Bob and Malia, and I will throw some Supreme Court questions at Bo after this brief underwriting break. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke here with Bo Breslin, Bob Brigham, and Malia Dumont. The email address for you to participate in the conversation is panel@wamc.org. Before the break, we began discussing the Trump administration's third country deportation policy ruling from a federal judge yesterday. Let us continue on this topic and go to Malia.
Well, as Bo pointed out, as he implied, the legal system doesn't move swiftly in these matters. So there have been emergency, I'm not a lawyer, I don't have a background in this, I don't know all the correct technical terms, but the emergency injunctions, emergency dockets, and it still takes months and months and months for it to proceed anywhere. And in the meantime, all these thousands of people are still in detention and are sort of in this terrible, terrible limbo, and more people are getting scooped up every day and put in detention. So
thank you for emphasizing that. We had kept the conversation fairly non-human up to the moment regarding this topic, which is, you know, important. The courts, it doesn't feel very humanistic and proceeds, you know, strictly as it must. But yes, these are people's lives we're talking about.
And there's still in a lot of communities around the country, there are ICE is trying to buy up warehouses and create new facilities, and they're contracting new people. So I think the administration, they view the lower courts and the process of law as sort of like a pesky annoyance and just something that's kind of a frustrating delay. So this, of course, they're going to appeal this decision. It's like they don't care that they may be doing something illegal. Their goals are not changing, which is to try to remove anyone who seems like a foreigner in their eyes from this country. That's my interpretation of what they're trying to do. So, okay, the Massachusetts, this district court puts some guardrails on that with this. They're going to appeal that. And then they're also going to, maybe they'll alter their approach slightly so that maybe it's illegal in a different way. And then that creates a whole new court procedure that has to be challenged. And it's all very slow. And in the meantime, thousands and thousands of people are suffering. And as we've seen, I think the last time I was on, we were talking about the fact that the administration had ignored over 100 court orders in Minnesota alone. And so, this one is high profile because it's a district court that said no to, a large policy. But every day, the administration is ignoring or going against all kinds of lower-level court orders, and judges are getting fed up. But it's going to end up with the Supreme Court. And we've seen it's only happened once so far with this tariff case. And just from this one Supreme Court ruling that was not in favor of what Trump wanted, suddenly the Supreme Court is an evil entity. And I don't know how it was that several justices weren't at the State of the Union. I guess they absented themselves. I don't know. But it's going to be a long-term, slow showdown with the Supreme Court. And again, I just want to emphasize, people have heard about what these detention facilities are like. If you've visited one, it's just they're horrendous. It's an ongoing, monstrous miscarriage of justice for thousands and thousands of people in this country.
Just picking up on what Malia said, if the detention centers in Dilley and other places in the United States are substandard, yeah. I can only imagine offshore where there's no oversight, no capacity. We don't have any regulation on much of what goes on in these black box facilities.
Right, and the rushed conversions from other types of buildings.
It just reeks all the while we're playing legal whack-a-mole, and that's the frustrating part. And even with the tariff case, Trump was announcing new tariffs within 24 hours of the Supreme Court's decision, and that seems to be his offensive policy. You ignore what they say. You try to change the narrative in the American public's mind by, announcing new tariffs that legally, I guess, can only be on for 150 days anyway. But the inconsistency of all of that stuff, it might be good for Trump in the short term politically, but in the long term, I think the United States is going to pay a price for that.
I totally agree. And let me just mention two quick things. One is, you know, one of the great things about this particular being on the show, the joy of being on the show, is I learned so much from other folks. And Malia
said... We call them panelists.
Panelists. Right.
On-air intelligentsia, is that what you said before?
I shouldn't have said that.
No, it's fine.
Lofty and yeah, not
panelists. But Malia says that she's absolutely right that the judiciary is a pesky annoyance for the Trump administration. It was a pesky annoyance for FDR, too. And what's interesting is that, you know, historically, we look back on FDR's court packing plan as an utterly radical and, you know, he never got it off the ground. Congress laughed at him, the court packing plan. But it was seen as sort of a historically important marker in American jurisprudence. I'm not sure that we're going to 50 years from now or 100 years from now, we're going to look back on anything the Trump administration has done because there's been so much to it. What made FDR's annoyance with the courts that generated the court packing plan so unusual is it was a one-off. It was the one way he thought he could control the court. I think the Trump administration tries every possible way to either ignore, derail, downplay, you know, condemn, insult the entire judiciary. And I hate to say it, but that the nature of that, the fights between the executive branch and the judiciary that come from the Trump administration may be with us over the long term. And that, I think, has serious ramifications for the history of America going forward.
And may continue to appeal to his base, right?
Yeah.
I think, Bo, you've raised some really interesting points here. And when we think about Roosevelt and the court packing scheme, even Democrats in Congress turned on him. And he lost a lot of seats in the next midterm election. And in fact, was considering his presidency over, that he was going to be the lamest duck of lame ducks in 1938. And then two things happened. The hurricane of 1938, where he had to step in with all those federal programs that had been established under the New Deal to bail New England and New York out. He saved lives. He saved jobs. He got all the New England Republican governors on his side. That started to resurrect his congressional life as well. And then, of course, Nazi Germany helped him immensely in bold terms. But Roosevelt was somewhat repentant and understood that he had made this political gamble and it was a mistake, and he was ready to retire and go off into the sunset. And I think you're absolutely right, Bo. Trump's policies are exactly the opposite. We are going to throw so much buckshot at everything that something is going to stick, distract, you know, obfuscate, and we'll just move on and roll on like the Supreme Court doesn't even exist.
Panel at WAMC.org. Jeffrey writes in and says, if the tariffs have been deemed an illegal action, where is the mass collection movement for businesses to recoup their losses? And I don't normally read people's signatures, the identifiers on the air, but this person is the owner-operator of a coffee company. So seems a personal question. And we've not...
I don't think your check's in the mail.
No, there isn't a plan, and we've not heard any, and we're not counting on...
And it's not surprising. People will criticize Roberts' opinion. It's not surprising that Roberts didn't go down that path. Roberts is a very technocratic judge. He's not going to have the broad sweeping opinions that Americans, quite frankly, have become used to from the Warren era all the way through the Rehnquist era. That's not Roberts' forte, and as a result, he's not going to tell us how those tariffs ought to be repaid.
Again, the email address, panel@wamc.org, in I guess, opinion piece by Linda Greenhouse, who is, I keep trying to touch screen this computer, and it is not a touch screen. She's a renowned American legal journalist, author, and academic, and she pointed out in a article that Beau sent me yesterday on the New York Times that Chief John Roberts, in regard to the tariff case, it was a very succinct report, a succinct ruling, 21 pages. Justice Gorsuch's was 46. Justice Brett Kavanaugh's dissent was 63 pages. And so in that, the sparseness of citation, he did include this paragraph, which Greenhouse thinks is very important. And I quote, "Since imposing each set of tariffs, the president has issued several increases, reductions, and other modifications. 1 month after imposing the 10% drug trafficking tariffs on Chinese goods, he increased the rate to 20%. 1 month later, he removed a statutory exemption for Chinese goods under $800. Less than a week after imposing the reciprocal tariffs, the president increased the rate on Chinese goods from 34% to 84%. The very next day, he increased the rate further still to 125%. This brought the total effective tariff rate on most Chinese goods to 145%. The president has also shifted sets of goods into and out of the reciprocal tariff framework, exempting from reciprocal tariffs beef, fruits, coffee, tea, spices, and some fertilizers. And he has issued a variety of other adjustments, like extending the suspension of heightened reciprocal tariffs on Chinese imports." And Ms. Greenhouse offers in her analysis that Justice Roberts' inclusion of this paragraph, which is really the double, triple, quadruple takes of these effects, as a sign that Chief Justice Roberts is becoming incredibly frustrated with this administration and is sending a, and the justice is sending a message not just to President Trump but also to the waiting world that perhaps the Supreme Court is, I don't want to sound so pie in the sky, but, you know, going to do some checks and balances coming up here.
Maybe. I mean, so Linda Greenhouse is distinguished, elegant, you know, she's a phenomenal writer. I'll be less that and say that.
Oh, that's, you're elegant, Bob.
No,
Mr. Breslin.
That's Robert's way of saying what Trump said about Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett's family. You know, you're a disgrace. And that's Robert's way of saying Trump is a disgrace. And the reality is, do I always think that, you know, Roberts is not going to switch in time like the old Justice Roberts did in the FDR days, a switch in time that saved nine. He's not going to be that person. He's conservative. I disagree with him 8 out of 10 times, maybe 9 out of 10 times. But he's trying to hold the court together, and he's trying to be a legitimate check. At least in this tariffs case, there are two cases that are coming up that I am super excited to hopefully get invited back to the roundtable to talk about. The birthright citizenship case on April 1st, oral argument is April 1st. That's going to tell us a lot. And then there's there's an election case on March 23rd that's going to tell us a lot, too. So those two cases I'm watching carefully. Let's see how Roberts can do in holding the court together as he did with the tariff case.
Our panelists this morning, Beau Breslin, Robert Brigham, Bob Brigham, and Malia Dumont. I'm Sarah LaDuc, hosting for Joe Donahue. The email address to join the conversation is panel@wamc.org. And we will return after some underwriting and news with Ray Graff. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuc, here with Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, Bob Brigham, and Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. You can join the conversation by emailing panel@wamc.org. And that is just what Linda did. She wrote in and said, regarding the stories we were talking about before the news break, and says, "Can we talk about the amount of profit and the people profiting from these detention centers? I've heard that the daily cost for each person is enormous. I've also heard that there are business ownings by the Trump family in detention centers. Do you know the facts on this? I think it is essential to the discussion." I think a lot of those facts are as obscured as possible, but let's discuss what we do know.
Yeah. What was the listener's name? Linda?
Linda.
Well, thank you, Linda, for bringing that up, because it's a very important aspect of this case. And unfortunately, I don't think a lot is publicly known about this, partly because the Trump administration, as it has in many other areas of government, is privatizing this effort. So when we hear about new detention centers being opened, it's not that the government is suddenly hiring a lot more government people and creating new government facilities. No, they are contracting out with private companies, many of which have supported the Trump presidential campaign and are making huge profits off of warehousing people. It is just absolutely disgusting. And it may be true that that if you break it down by person, that the per capita cost of warehousing someone in this way in one of these detention facilities is pretty high. But I can tell you from my personal observation that it won't surprise any of our listeners that the detainees themselves are not the beneficiaries of that. That these centers oftentimes don't have these are not well established like long term prisons where there's a prison yard that people can go out in or there are, you know, the established procedures. A lot of times people have no place to go outside. They're held for months in overcrowded cells where temperatures are kept deliberately low. There are no windows. I mean, it's you get the same food three times a day. There's, you know, theoretically there's a library, but you don't actually have access to it in real life.
Well, and who knows if the materials are in a language you could read.
Right. So I'll just provide a little bit more color on this. So the one facility I visited, it's a privately run facility in Newark, New Jersey. It's called Delaney Hall, and it is under contract to DHS from a private company called the GEO Group. And the GEO Group has a number of these facilities throughout the country. And if you look at the GEO Group website, it looks really beautiful. And they literally have pictures of like little blonde-haired girls, like, I don't know, having fun visiting it's the strangest thing, and it does not reflect reality. And it says things on the website like, you can send packages to your detainee and they can pick it up at such and such time. And visiting hours are like all day long, Saturday and Sunday. But you get into the details and actually, no, they can't accept packages. No, visiting hours aren't all that day. It's like you show up, as what happened with me. I showed up during the visiting hours and found out, no, within that 12-hour time period set aside for visiting hours, the visiting hour for the cell block that I was going into was actually 1 hour within that time period. That's not publicized. So I found out fortunately, I showed up before that hour started, but I didn't know that ahead of time. I didn't know that in order to go into the place, there's certain kinds of clothing. I mean, none of this is on the website that you're not allowed to wear. I showed up because I was trying to represent. I showed up in a Bard College hoodie because I was going to visit a Bard College student who is detained. And they said, no, you can't wear a hoodie into this facility. And I was already inside the outer perimeter. And so I had to strip down literally to my underwear in the parking lot, borrow a top from someone else who was trying to visit that I had never met before, a stranger in the parking lot, so I could go into this facility. And it's the whole thing is dehumanizing, not just for the detainees, that's very clear, but also for the people who work there. So what I saw in Newark is you know, I didn't have conversations with the guards or the people running the facility, but from my observation, these are not jobs that require a lot of education. I assume they don't pay all that well. And it's local people looking for an opportunity. There aren't that many jobs in that part of Newark. And so they're being put in a position or maybe they would, if this isn't the job, their dream job, right? But they're being put in this position of herding these detainees like cattle. And I felt like the entire time I was in there, I felt like I was in a Kafka story, that every single part of this machinery is dehumanizing. And these faceless rich people behind the GEO Group are just, they don't care about any of it, and they're laughing all the way to the bank.
I would second everything Malia just said and say that, you know, Core Civic is another one of those, along with GEO Group, that owns a lot of these. And that
even the name choices for the companies is so intentionally like semi-positive and vague.
Right. And I think when we get done uncovering all the graft and corruption in this administration in 20 years, this will be one of the focal points. I think, as Malia has said, you know, the guards are there to try to make a living. It's not where the money is. The money is in the buying of these warehouses and the contracts. Just a cursory view of the purchases that are planned over the next 10 months show that some of these facilities, some of these warehouses that DHS is going to buy are being purchased for 10 to 15 times their market value.
Right.
Where's that money going? It's not going to the guards, and it's certainly not going to the people who are being inhumanely detained there. So there's money being made, but again, it's floating up. It's not helping the condition. It's not helping the guard. It's not helping any of the humans at the lived level here, and that's emblematic of this administration.
And I'll just add one other thing, that I think it adds a layer of inscrutability, because these are nominally they're private facilities, right? They're under contract to the federal government, but they're private facilities. So that creates just an extra layer of making it hard for government officials who want accountability to take it. So if you look up Delaney Hall in the news, you'll see that I think the mayor of Newark and a Democratic congressman were arrested there and accused of like violent trespassing when all they were trying to do was go in and inspect the facility, as they should be allowed to do. But it's just that much harder for people who don't agree with these practices to get in and view them and see them.
So smart. I'm just going to say one more thing, just to add on to the dehumanization. One of the first things to go when you're dehumanizing is due process. And, you know, let's not forget about the fact that folks deserve and are entitled to due process in ways that this administration has ignored and scorned.
We've essentially said this, but I want to add that it isn't as if this system was etch-a-sketched and everybody was allowed out, they wouldn't still be coping with physical and mental health detriment from the way they've been treated in these facilities all this time. It's devastating, and the repercussions will be generational. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Your panel this morning, Beau Breslin, Bob Brigham, and Malia Dumont. Let us go now to the hearing yesterday featuring President Trump's Surgeon General nominee, Dr. Casey Means. Dr. Casey Means testified before a Senate committee on Wednesday, that's yesterday, in her bid to be confirmed as the nation's top doctor. The hearing was a long time coming for Means, a wellness influencer, entrepreneur, and author who had to delay the confirmation hearing in late October because she was pregnant and went into labor. Congratulations to her and her family. During her testimony, Means praised Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s leadership and echoed many of the talking points of his Make America Healthy Again agenda, while sidestepping pointed questions about the administration's controversial actions on vaccines and other issues. In podcast appearances and online, Means has expressed concerns about the safety of the childhood vaccine schedule and questioned hormonal birth control. She has also endorsed raw milk, as has RFK. Her nomination has faced considerable pushback from the medical and public health establishment, in part because she lacks the clinical experience of past surgeons general. Dr. George Benjamin, the CEO of the American Public Health Association, said she's less qualified professionally than any other surgeon general in history, and there is no question about that. Means graduated from Stanford Medical School, but dropped out of a surgical training to become a head and neck surgeon. She went on to open a functional medicine practice in Oregon, though she stopped seeing patients a few years ago and does not currently have an active medical license. What do we think about the nomination? What do we think about the hearing? Who would like to begin?
So your two top medical people in the country, neither one of them could prescribe an antibiotic. That's what I think about that. That's a disgrace. Means is known for making false statements about the rate of medical doctor errors. She's known for taking money as an influencer in the medical field and
endorsing products,
and then, you know, making that sound medical advice. The two of them, you know, are part of the Maha universe. They believe in wellness, but they don't believe in health. It's an interesting moment. I think, you know, this is kind of tragic, of course, that we have these two people at the top of the medical pyramid that don't have medical licenses now, either one of them. But it's also, I think, in a broader sense, if you think about Trump wanting to drain the swamp, I don't think this is draining the swamp. I think this is destroying the wetlands. And there's a big difference to me. So when you are someone like Trump who has that ideological bent, you want the institutions to go, to disappear. And here's, you know, here are some of the most important institutional frameworks for the health and well-being of our society. And we have web influencers at the top.
I just point out the job is Surgeon General. Surgeon General, not Wellness Guru General. I don't get it. But so when I was reading some of Ms. Means's recent statements, I was almost like a little bit encouraged because she talks about the importance of an environment.
She thread the needle.
Yeah, you quickly realize, like, actually, she's what I would characterize as a proponent of radical individualism. It's environment, but it's the environment you yourself create. It's the environment you yourself choose, as if we all have the same ability and access to the choices to make medical decisions in our life, which is not true. And that's why one of the reasons we have government. But everything that she seems to be in favor of is about individuals making choices that make sense only for them and not taken in a context of society. So it's not surprising in the context of this administration, but it's really disheartening.
Yeah. So in 2017, 9 out of 10 Americans had trust and faith in the CDC. Today, it's less than 5 out of 10 Americans have that same faith. And this is part of, I think this is part of a pattern that will permanently damage Americans' trust in the public health sector, right? And all we have to do is go back to Trump's first administration, Trump's anti-Fauci, you know, crusade, one. Two, Trump's absurd stance on COVID during the entirety, like as he started to say this is going to be a week or two and then we should all drink bleach in order to get rid of it. The dramatic decimation of the CDC over the last 8 years and most recently in his second administration. I think the elimination of USAID has a very real consequence for public health broadly understood. Let's not forget that USAID was the central arm for our medical imprint around the world. The elevation of of RFK, as you both have said, healthcare challenges, you know, the constant fight for Obamacare, inequities and discrimination in the healthcare system have only been exacerbated under this current administration, misinformation and so on. So, you know, there are three of us who are deeply involved in academia on this particular panel, panelists that are in academia. I can tell you a story about Skidmore. Skidmore has long discussed the idea of coming up with a public health concentration, public health minor. I don't know if Bard and Vassar have it, but it's a more significant uphill climb if Skidmore decides to do that today than it was when I was in the dean's office from 2011 to 2018. And I think that is a tragedy when it comes to the way in which we situate the next generation of folks in the public health sector. And I blame it entirely on an administration that just seems to not know what it's doing.
Our president is one of the leading public health scholars in the country. She used to be at Yale School of Public Health, and she's a very prolific scholar on public health.
This is Vassar.
This is Vassar College, President Elizabeth Bradley. And we do take public health very seriously at Vassar. I want to just step back for a minute and just see. For me, everything the Trump administration does is so short term, it's dangerous. 70 years ago, public health was something that the United States embraced not only domestically but internationally. We constructed a liberal post-war order with the World Bank, with the IMF, with the World Health Organization, and the modernizers, the theorists, the economists, the
USAID.
Public health experts, USAID,
yeah.
All of these, it came a little later, it came in 61, but in the 50s particularly, these modernizers believed that the United States, to win the battle of hearts and minds in the southern world, the best thing the United States could do was not nation build necessarily, was not do counterinsurgency programs, but was uplift peoples in the southern world to get enough calories to, we're going to eradicate smallpox, we're going to eradicate malaria. It was an outward facing international New Deal for the world in many ways, based on public health. So now to destroy it at home, to absolutely decimate it abroad, is short-sighted, and it is detrimental to the well-being of Americans and our fellow global citizens. It's just, this may, if we all survive this, this may be one of the biggest tragedies of this administration.
Yeah, and public health is something, to have experts in public health, you need graduate study. I mean, a lot of colleges, you can sort of, whether there's a formal concentration in it or not, you can sort of cobble together your interests and learn about aspects of public health. But where you really become someone who can function in a public health profession, you need graduate study for that. And the universities that that kind of study takes place in bigger research universities typically. And those are the places that that have suffered the most from the withdrawal of federal funding and grants. So it's like a double whammy.
Yeah, and I'll be in big trouble back home if I don't say that Malia's absolutely right. So what President Bradley has done is partner with Columbia University so you can get a five-year master's and bachelor's through Vassar and Columbia. But you do. You need the big research university to get to the higher level medical stuff. But this is just
can we gear up the investment in the global south, Bob, the way you're talking about it, after the Trump administration, or is it so decimated that it's going to take generations?
It's going to take generations.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to think about the context of the 1950s and, you know, the economic boom that was taking place in the United States and the purposeful decision to take somewhat limited resources, even though it was a boom economy, and to spend them on these issues because winning that Cold War was so important in this way. You couldn't go to university in the 50s in America and not have that ethos. It was instilled, this economic modernization, the liberalism that's going to inhabit so many of these things. And to see it destroyed in this way so that, I mean, besides draining the swamp, I mean, is this so our bodies can be harvested easier by large economic, I mean, I don't know what the end goal here is besides just the total destruction of all meaningful institutions in this democracy.
In her testimony, her confirmation hearing, Dr. Casey Means was scrutinized on past comments on birth control and psychedelics. Washington Democratic Senator Patty Murray asked Means to address her past comments that birth control pills were being prescribed like candy, quote, and showed a, quote, disrespect of things that create life. Means said she thinks oral contraceptives should be available to all women, but raised concerns about what she called the horrifying side effects that can occur in certain populations. And then she says a sentence that is true inside of this conversation, which is doctors do not have enough time for a thorough, informed consent conversation, which doctors do not have enough time often for you know, this best and specific plan for their patients. And then according to the American College, we want to point out regarding birth control, according to the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, hormonal birth control methods such as the pill, patch, or ring are safe for most people, but are associated with a small increased risk of deep vein thrombosis, heart attack, and stroke. The risk is higher when there are other contributing factors. And then another topic in the testimony, Senator Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, noted that Casey Means touted the therapeutic use of psychedelic mushrooms in her book and tried them herself. And Casey said, what I would say as a private citizen is in many cases different than what I'd say as a public health official, Means replied, adding she wouldn't recommend psychedelics for the public.
Two quick things that I'll throw out there in response to that. One is the, probably historically it's always been this way, but the ridiculousness of these sorts of confirmation hearings, right? You're gonna, right. And even though I think some of this is absurd, her conversation with Bill Cassidy was interesting, or, you know, the Senator Kane, and you know, it is performative. It is no matter what they're confirming, these people are going to say, are going to thread the needle as best they can. The one thing that struck me in riffing off of Sarah, what you said, the one thing that struck me that she said is science is continually evolving, or science is.
She said never settled.
Never settled, right? On the one hand, sure, from an academic perspective, we can say that. On the other hand, science also gives us pretty solid answers. And whether it's vaccines or other public health initiatives have shown to be effective, that doesn't mean the jury is still out on these sorts of things. So it's an intellectual, you know, sort of dance that she did in that moment that really struck me as disingenuous.
I'll just point out that I think many people who are on birth control are on birth control precisely because they do have a very deep respect for life and a very deep understanding of what it would mean to have another life in their life. And otherwise, they wouldn't feel the need to be on birth control. So that's just a specious argument.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Our panel this morning, Bo Breslin, Bob Brigham, and Malia Dumont. The email address for you to join the conversation is panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will return after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke. The email address to join the conversation is panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Do keep your letters short, to the point, and on topic. Please don't include links or attachments, and don't use obscure abbreviations. If you have a sec before you hit send, proofread that baby. Makes it easier to read it on the air. Again, the email address, panel at WAMC.org. Our panel this morning, Joseph Palo Mountain Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Bo Breslin, Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, Bob Brigham, and Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. We continue the conversation with this email from Scott, who says, thank you for bringing up the drain the swamp metaphor. Based on my experience in the civil environmental engineering field, you should know that in industrialized America, the primary reason to drain a swamp is to build a landfill and fill that former swamp with garbage. I find this to be an appropriate metaphor.
Good for you.
That's a great awesome. Letter.
That's good.
Gallows humor. Panel at WAMC.org. Christine says, is this still Planet Earth, USA, etc.? What have I missed? Interesting, which is similar to what I said as soon as the mic's shut, which is, what are we going to do? Panel at WAMC.org. Please do keep your comments coming. We are not going to have any in-depth discussion about the Epstein files today, but I did want to point out that Hillary Clinton is testifying this morning or this afternoon. We will talk about that on the show tomorrow and go now to
Can I ask a question about that?
Of course.
Not to get into the Epstein files, but do you think, other than scheduling, do you think there is a reason why Hillary is going before Bill? Because Bill's tomorrow.
I do not have the knowledge base to speculate on that. Bob, do you know?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Me either.
No? I just thought it was, I thought it was interesting because, of course, Hillary is providing, you know, secondary hearsay type information, and Bill is the main player here. I just thought it was weird that Hillary was going first.
And the coverage of former President Clinton's involvement does include many pictures and emails of President Bill Clinton with Jeffrey Epstein. But as of now, former President Clinton has not been accused of sexual assault or pedophilia. I think that's important to point out. But I will all say again, whomever is found guilty of those violations does deserve to be
prosecuted.
Thank you. And if found guilty, etc. Let us go now to the Middle East. As I said, everything is so upsetting, but here we go. Made headlines in 2018 when a U.S. ambassador to Israel made an official visit to an Israeli settlement in the West Bank, breaking a longstanding foreign policy taboo. Again, that was in 2018. But currently, the U.S. will offer embassy services in West Bank settlements for the first time. These are going to be pop-up embassies. On Friday, the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem has announced it will set up shop in Efrat, a fast-growing Jewish settlement, to offer American citizens assistance with their passports. The embassy plans to do the same in Beitar Elite, an ultra-Orthodox settlement, in the coming months. Such one-day consular pop-ups have operated before in Palestinian towns in the West Bank, like Ramallah and Taibe, and they are also planned in Israeli cities of Haifa, Beit Shemesh, and Netanya. But officials said Friday this would be the first time consular services were delivered in an Israeli settlement. The settlements are seen by many international organizations to be illegal. And this is the first time the U.S. has engaged with them in such a way. Let us talk about what this means, what it could mean, what we know, et cetera. We'll start with you, Bob.
Yeah, I'd be curious to find out where this decision was made that come all the way from the top, or is this a local decision? On the surface, of course, this looks like it normalizes settlements. And that's the optics that I think are interesting here. It's not unusual for an embassy to have pop-up consulates, not just in this region, but all around the world. But they're generally pop-up consulates for specific purposes. Like, you know, there's a holiday coming up and there's going to be a lot of visa traffic, or you know, there's, you know, some event. But this kind of untethered pop-up consulate is interesting. So, I mean, I think the first take by most journalists, which is a first take on history, of course, is that this is a way to have it look like that the settlements are normalized, a part of the landscape, and have always and should always be there.
Yeah, I agree. And it just seems disingenuous for the embassy to say otherwise. Maybe they don't want to broadly announce a big policy change. So they're doing these pop-up consulates. And then they say, oh, this isn't a change. But, it clearly is.
It clearly is.
Yeah,
we've never been there
is.
Before.
Yeah. Maybe it's some kind of trial balloon to see what the reaction will be. Time will tell.
I think it's so at the risk of broadening the conversation a little bit.
Why would that be a problem?
Oh, no.
No, let's stay right in the narrowest lane. Okay, goodness gracious.
You've been ruthless today.
Sorry. It's my love language, honestly.
Right. Okay, fair enough.
Teasing.
Let's date back to Trump's first term. And I think there's a decent amount that happened under the Obama administration that we should talk about, too. But dating back to Trump's first term, 2017, the embassy has moved to Jerusalem, right? That was a huge deal. So Jerusalem is recognized as Israel's capital. The State Department announces it will no longer consider West Bank settlements as illegal under this happened in his first term, too. Three, the administration recognizes the Golan Heights, reversing decades of policy where U.S. saw it as an occupied area. U.S. Consulate General in Jerusalem was merged with the U.S. Embassy, essentially closing a de facto embassy for Palestinians in that period. The administration cut funding to the U.N. Agency for Palestinian Refugees. This too happened under the Trump administration. And then, of course, this is all within the orbit and backdrop of the Abraham Accords, right? This attempt to understand or the attempt to normalize relationships between Israel and other Arab states. I think the Trump administration has been showing us over and over and over again its willingness to support Israel in the types of things that Netanyahu, because of his far right coalition, wants. This one, I think, Bob, you're right. It's a first glance at it. But my guess is that it's just part of an ongoing pattern that, and we'll find out later on that yes, indeed, there was. It goes pretty high up, and there was an attempt on the part of the White House or the Oval Office even to, you know, just to continue this trend of pro-Israeli stuff at the expense of Palestinian support.
Liberal critics of the embassy's announcement noted that it was at odds with President Trump's repeated statements rejecting Israeli annexation of the West Bank and that Ambassador Mike Huckabee is a longtime supporter of annexation. The Trump people are so focused on Gaza that they completely miss what's happening in the West Bank, says Nadav Tamir, executive director of the Israel office of J Street and liberal pro-Israel lobby. Huckabee is supposed to be their representative in Israel, but he has a completely different world view. An embassy spokesman declined to make Mr. Huckabee available for the interview. Not surprised about that. Mr. Tamir characterized the consular pop-ups in settlements as creeping recognition of sovereignty, and much of Israel's moves to enhance its grip on the West Bank are often likened to creeping annexation.
Yeah, it's really interesting that this administration has so hollowed out the State Department, and yes, it weaponizes it in this way and in this fashion and in this place. It's duplicitous, I think.
And the other thing I'll say, it pains me, and I think we've gotten letters in the past where I've talked about this, and people accuse me of not knowing what I'm talking about, which is probably true. But we're slowly creeping away from any possibility of a two-state solution, which for me, as a political scientist, I think is the only way that there will be stability and peace in the area, or at least some semblance of stability and peace. And every small move like this, pop-up embassies in the West Bank, is a creep away from the two-state possibility.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. We will take our final underwriting break of the show a little bit early and be back with you momentarily. Our panelists are Beau Breslin, Bob Brigham, and Malia Dumont. I'm Sarah LeDuc, and we'll be back after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc here with Beau Breslin, Bob Brigham, and Malia Dumont. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Mediated talks involving, this from the New York Times, Iranian and American negotiators in Geneva have paused as the sides break to consult with their capitals, according to two officials involved in the discussions. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said negotiations would reconvene at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, that's 5:30 p.m. local time in Geneva. The pause suggests the side's representatives feel enough has been raised to warrant continuing the negotiations later in the day. Here's what to know about the talks between the U.S. and Iran that have taken place thus far. The United States and Iran began high-stakes nuclear talks in Geneva on Thursday, that could determine whether the two countries will go to war or strike a deal. Oman's foreign minister Badr Albu Saidi is mediating the talks and said the two sides were exchanging creative and positive ideas. President Trump said in his State of the Union on Tuesday, as we know, that he preferred to resolve the standoff with Iran through diplomacy. But he added, "I will never allow the world's top sponsor of terror, which they are by far, have a nuclear weapon. Can't let that happen." End quote. Iran, however, has said that it will never totally give up nuclear enrichment. "Our fundamental convictions are crystal clear. Iran will under no circumstance ever develop a nuclear weapon. Neither will we Iranians ever forego our right to harness the dividends of peaceful nuclear technology for our people," that Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said in a social media post. Iran is expected to offer a proposal designed to maintain some level of enrichment while also allowing Mr. Trump to declare victory. Four Iranian officials, who were not authorized to speak publicly, said Iran would offer a suspension of nuclear activity and the enrichment of uranium for 3 to 5 years. After that, the country would join a regional nuclear consortium while maintaining a very low level of enrichment, 1.5% for medical research. That was percent. It's not the word I said. It's the word I meant to say. It would also offer to dilute 400 kilograms of highly enriched uranium it still maintains in phases while allowing access to inspectors from the United Nations Atomic Agency to oversee all steps and monitor compliance. Bob.
Well, there's so many moving parts here. You know, clearly the Trump administration has been rattling at the saber. They've moved aircraft carriers to the region, upping military pressure all along. The negotiations probably, my guess is, won't amount to much. The beginning of this crisis, Trump said that he supported the protesters inside Iran at any level. They went out on the line and got chewed up by the government, and the Trump administration hasn't shown a significant amount of support for those protesters. And then there was the pivot to the nuclear issue once again, complicated for Trump because the strikes on the nuclear facility were supposed to have, in his words, wiped it out completely. Well, that's clearly not true. There's still much to talk about. But to me, what's really important here are the things that are not making the press. For example, today, and I think this is one of the reasons the talks are starting today, and they're going to be polite today, but they might change very quickly. The British government is about to sign over the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. It's part of a long-standing agreement. They signed a new treaty in May of 2025. On the surface, that doesn't mean much. It'd be nice vacation land for some people, but it's where Diego Garcia is. And that is the joint UK-US base that's going to be absolutely vital for the United States to have any military presence in the Middle East. The United States and Britain, it's essentially a British base that the United States subleases. And it was absolutely crucial in all the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's going to be leased at £101 million a year. So this is a significant thing. Those negotiations are probably yesterday. A member of the Foreign Secretary's office in Britain said that they had the negotiations for the final bit of the treaty had paused, and then he was severely reprimanded because they did not pause. They're trying to rush that through today to have that treaty signed and the transfer over so that the United States knows exactly what its position is in Diego Garcia before it rattles the saber even harder on Iran. So I think they were going to be in a holding pattern until some of these other atmospherics get sorted out. I also think the last thing that Trump clearly wants the tail wagging the dog here, right, to distract and obfuscate from bad economy, Epstein files, all sorts of things. But I don't even think that his administration would be reckless as to make a bold move right now before some of these other things are settled.
So the Chagos Islands have for centuries been under complete colonizational command by European countries, and the natives are
about to be returned to Mauritius with this one major exception,
right.
Diego Garcia.
Yes.
Well, Bob's absolutely right about the strategic criticality of Diego Garcia from a U.S. Military and defense point of view. These negotiations feel in some ways like a little bit of a throwback. It's like kind of like classic diplomatic efforts that we haven't seen the Trump administration engaging in a lot of other areas. So that's why we don't know exactly what Iran's concessions might be. I mean, there's some talk on the sidelines, but this is typically how these kind of talks would proceed. You know, they gather in Geneva. There's an intermediary. In this case, it's Oman, who's kind of like a neutral party in the region, so to speak. So I find the sort of diplomatic infrastructure that's being used in this case kind of interesting because the Trump administration isn't using it in a lot of other places. But it seems like both sides see some utility in engaging in these discussions. So I'm hopeful. I mean, as long as talks continue, it means that war is not imminent, right? And so I find that to be a hopeful sign.
What's the broader foreign policy and diplomacy strategy on the part of Trump? Now, I know a lot of this stuff is not, you know, it's not the same. The environments are very different, but there was no negotiation when we kidnapped Maduro. There was no, and yet there's been attempts, you know, negotiations as we sort of think of the Geneva situation here with Iran, was central to getting us some sort of peace in Israel and Gaza. The Ukraine, the Russia-Ukraine battle negotiations haven't worked. I'm still trying to figure out what the strategy is. And if the strategy just depends on the region or the geography or what's possible, then unfortunately, there is no strategy. So I'll throw it open to the group.
Yeah, I don't think there's a strategy. I think there's serious tactical conversations, perhaps. Maybe not. I mean,
I think the strategy is not pissing off the Saudis.
Yeah. Or, and also, I mean, I think
a huge
part of this is not to do with the nuclear weapons at all, really. A huge part of this is to do with non-nuclear ballistic missiles that Israel wants to see removed as well. So there's, I mean, the Trump administration has a lot of pressures on it. I do think there's some difference between the way it handles Venezuela and the way it handles Iran, and that Iran has enormous projectable power. And Venezuela simply doesn't. I think they're treading lightly, and I think they should tread lightly. There's a lot of saber rattling and a lot of, you know, front page stuff. But I don't think even this administration wants to.
Right, and I think our partners in the region don't want to see an overly heavy-handed U.S. approach.
Yeah.
What constitutes a success for Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff? Is it just further delay of the potential of bombing Iran?
I don't know if the success is actually possible, but ending Iran's nuclear enrichment, I mean, that would be success. And you can categorize almost anything that is even a move in that direction as a success, because the great thing about diplomacy is it takes time, right? There's flexibility. There are achievements along the way to the ultimate goal. I think they'll continue to state that as the ultimate goal. And even if at the end of this talk, like, there's just an opening for further talk, that can be characterized as still moving towards that goal. The door is still open.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of pressure on Trump. His base doesn't want this necessarily, and yet they want regime change. You know, if you ever look at polling around conflict, it's totally inconsistent. I think that's what the Trump people are dealing with, is that there's no appetite in the base for an actual conflict with Iran.
They want regime change, but
right,
no U.S.
Yeah, exactly,
military on the
exactly.
ground.
Exactly. It's like during Vietnam, if you looked at polling, should the United States be in Vietnam? No. But should the United States win? Yes. I mean, it's totally inconsistent. And so I think trying to read the tea leaves on what their actual diplomatic strategy is quite difficult. And I think it's going to be more ad hoc than it should be, perhaps, because there are all these different interests in the room. So you've got the Kushner and Witkoff interests. Those are very specific. I think Trump himself probably wants regime change. But what the professionals, if there are any left in the room, would say is, yeah, but we don't want to own this problem the day after, right? We've already been there for the last 30 years. It cost us $1 trillion, and it didn't. You know, it led to all sorts of problems. And remember that your political career was built on being anti that. So there's a lot of stuff that goes into this diplomatic stew. And the longer the talks proceed, I think the safer for everybody involved. No rash actions.
Let's wrap it up there. No rash actions. That'll be the
whole good
advice, the mantra, the push. Bo Breslin, Bob Brigham, and Malia Dumont, thank you as ever for your participation. We really appreciate you.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks.
You are listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.